Hello, this is Dave Dawes from entrepreneurses.net, and I'm bringing you Firestarters, the UK's first social enterprise in health podcast. This is part two of a workshop on how to create a social enterprise. So if you missed part one, you might want to go back and listen to that week's first. I just want to do one more bit on, because we're coming on to structures now. Okay. A lot of people ask about legal structures. Funnily enough, the questions I get asked most, nobody believes it, this is the simple stuff. So I get a lot about legal structures, I get asked a lot about business plans. It's really quite easy, and I'll explain why. But there are basically seven legal models for being a social enterprise. There are straight company, limited by shares, limited by guarantee, which is exactly the same as the private sector. So, and actually most social enterprises are this, because up until fairly recently, that was tend to be what you did. When we set up the foundation 5 years ago, and we weren't really sure what we were, and we'd never heard the word social enterprise, things that did the sort of thing we did were companies limited by guarantee, so that's just what we became. We didn't really think that much about it, that's just kind of what you tended to be. Just quickly, the main thing, if you're a company, you are registered by Companies House, you will have a number. And Companies House say once a year, you have to send us a return, you have to have a minimum of two directors, you have to have a company secretary, but actually setting up a company is not that difficult. We could set up a company this morning, it will be live by this afternoon. And it's what most of the private sector do to trade. The difference between a company and an individual is a company is registered by Companies House. If you're not a company and you've not got a company number, then you're not actually a company entity. And certainly if you're looking at getting contracts, that becomes a problem. So I know a lot of people who work as sole traders, who work as self-employed, who will hit some of these problems. They're none of these. But I would say if you're a sole trader, if you're not a company. And so you're actually none of the other page. You're an individual on your own. Okay? So the main difference, I will come back to that. So then there's two other types. There's community interest companies, or CICs. And they were created specifically to help social enterprises as a kind of, this is the right legal model. Because what people were saying was, well, if you're a company limited by shares and guarantee, structurally you look identical to Virgin and Boots and, HMV. So how do we tell the difference? So people said, well, let's create a different structure. So a community interest company is a special type of company. They come in two flavours, limited by shares and guarantee. But they have a number of special clauses. They're regulated by something called the Community Interest Regulator. And he will not only regulate that you're doing all the company stuff legally, which is essentially, don't break the law, send in a return once a year, send in accounts once a year. That's pretty much all you have to do to legally say as a company. They will also regulate to see what public good you're doing. So if you say you're going to do public good and you don't do public good and you're a CIC, the regulator could step in and go, you're not actually doing what you're supposed to be doing. You are set up to be public good and you are not. We want to see evidence of it. The other thing these things have is something called an asset lock. And an asset lock means that if this sits on millions, it can't give those to individuals and it cannot give them to shareholders by law. And in the event of it being wound up, it can't even go to the creditors. So that's an interesting aspect of a CIC. Then what we have is cooperatives, or IPAs, Industrial Provident Societies. They've been around probably the longest. And so the big name ones, the Co-op Bank is one.
Credit unions call it that then?
Sorry?
Credit unions.
I think credit unions are a special type of that. I can dig up. Credit unions are a special, because credit unions are also regulated by the finance and banking people. So I think they're a hybrid, but I know it's not my area at all, but I can dig up. Then what you have is, so co-ops are owned by the members. So the basic idea behind it, so we could form a co-op now, we would all be the members, and the idea is we collectively decide who's the management team and the board of directors, we all have a vote, we can change the directors, and we can distribute the profits to ourselves. So that's the idea of a co-op. And as I said earlier, one of the weird things is, a lot of people say, well, GP co-ops are co-ops because they're structured. There's no legal difference, but to me there's a difference between poor Kenyan farmers distributing money to poor Kenyan farmers and, you know, rich white middle class people distributing money to rich white middle class people. But legally, there is no difference.
John Lewis, a co-op.
Yeah. Yeah.
John Lewis. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing about people, a lot of people associate co-ops with social enterprise, think they're the same. And there are co-ops who really don't trade for public good. I mean, I'm talking about neutral people. There is the Israeli Water Cannon Cooperative that makes weapons for dispersing crowds and being used in Palestine and suppressing people. And it's a cooperative. It's not remotely about social good at all. So then you have registered charities. That's quite that's often what voluntary groups emerged into. Voluntary groups usually don't have a legal structure. So they've usually got like a bank account, a couple of signatories. The registered charity gives them a structure. They get regulated by the Charity Commission. They have a very tight set of rules to operate in, and they get given a number. So if someone says they're a registered charity, the first people ask is, what's your registered charity number? All of these also have numbers. So you can find out who someone is, check them against the register. Then you have limited liability partnership, which is a bit of a weird one. And is essentially a way that, say, we could all create a limited liability partnership, which is a bit like a company. It's subtly different from a co-op, in that, in effect, we're all individual people. We would all get individual income streams from our money. We would make decisions collectively, but we're not sort of legally bound together. So that's a real whistle to stop tour. People got any kind of questions? Or I'll come on to how you choose later. But this is a kind of, does any of that just completely not make sense? Or, I mean, do say, because I didn't know my way around this at all. I spent ages on Companies House website and talking to lawyers and going, what's the difference between that and that? And pros and cons.
Am I correct in assuming that the top two sections, the companies, limited or the community interest companies,
yeah,
are the only ones that have to have a board of directors?
No. All of those do. All of them do.
Including the co-op,
yeah,
and registered.
Yeah, yeah. Except registered charity calls them trustees, but it's essentially a board of directors. They sometimes get called different things, but in a sense, there is a number of people who are elected or appointed to that role who do it on behalf of the company that have the legal duties of a director. So if you're on the board of a registered charity, you have the duties of a registered charity, are basically duties of a director plus some other stuff. Yeah.
What's a guarantee?
Right. This is the interesting bit. One of the main reasons why people go from being sole trader to a company, right, is this limited bit. And this is great. Because what that means is if the company goes bankrupt, the individual directors don't take the hit on the money. Now, there's two ways you can do it. And I thought this was completely esoteric. And I hit a real problem 3 years ago because we picked the wrong one. So one thing I'd say is you need to get good advice about which one of these you do, because some of them you can't go from one to the other. There are some routes you can, but some you can't. If you're limited by guarantee, then basically what happens is you guarantee that in the event of the company being bankrupt, you will pay an amount to the creditors, which is normally £1. So if you look at the memorandum and articles of a company limited by guarantee, it says in the event of us being insolvent, the directors or the members, depends on how it's structured, guarantee, which is that bit, to pay £1 to the debtors, and anything else is tough. So what the company, so basically the trade-off is, in effect, the law said, if you agree to abide by a set of rules and a set of behaviours, then in return, we will protect you as an individual from the consequences of your company. That's kind of the trade-off. So there's a set of rules to follow, which aren't that strenuous. But if you follow those rules and it all goes pear-shaped and your company goes insolvent, you owe millions of pounds, you as an individual director do not get hit with millions of pounds. Does that make sense? So a guarantee means you agree to give like £1. Shares mean you buy shares in the company, which again normally have a nominal value of £1. So the idea is if that goes insolvent, you pay the value of your shares. So say there's 100 shares, they're £1, you might pay 70 quid or 30 quid or, you know. But it's always like small amounts of money. You could make it 30p if you want, just tends to be £1, don't know why. The big difference between those and those is this has something called equity. So does anyone watch The Dragon's Den?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we actually got equity a couple of years ago. We got 60 grand from a a hard-nosed venture capitalist from the city and not a social enterprise. One of the first problems we have is the essence of an equity deal is you need money, I'll give you money. In return for that money, I want an ownership of the company, a chunk of it. So you know when they do that deal, like, I'll give you 30%, I'll give you 50%, I'm going to have a chat with Barry, no, we're not going below 17%, and it's all a bit rubbish, really. But the idea is you have equity, you can do some stuff with that equity. So if you take something like Google, and if you'd invested in Google, say about 10 years ago, you'd be wearing Jimmy Choo's, you'd be driving a couple of BMWs or a range of colours, depending on your day of the week, you'd have made an awful lot of money because you had equity and that equity increased in value. So people on the stock market have equity and they trade this stuff.
But so, what if the company loses value? Does that 60, the original investment, then have to go back to the... Or do they take the same risk?
Well, no, all you've guaranteed is your pound. So even Google, which is worth, I don't know, 50 billion or something, probably the actual, if it all went pear-shaped, it's probably 100 quid divvied up amongst four or five people, is usually the way it's done. So it's all, then you never ever, no matter how bad it gets, have to put in more than, like a pound a share or a pound. So it's nominal, you know, it's not kind of earth-shattering. Does that make sense?
So are you saying, Dave, that all these are social enterprise models?
All of these can operate as a social enterprise. And all of them have pros and cons. There's no perfect model. The acid test for me on a good legal advisor is if you go to a good legal advisor, first thing he'll ask you is, what are you trying to do? I'll go through those questions later. What are you trying to do? Why are you trying to do it? How do you want to be accountable? Right. Here's the pros and cons. I think it will probably suit these ones. Anyone who tells you you need to be X and doesn't say there are pros and cons to all of them is rubbish. Get yourself a different lawyer. And I can recommend about three or four firms who will say to you, here are the pros and cons. Because the big pros and cons are, if you're a company limited, if you're a company limited by guarantee, you have no equity. If you have no equity, it's very hard to do an equity. We actually did a sort of equity deal. But it's very, very hard because there's no ownership. You can't issue shares. So someone can't say, if you're a company limited by guarantee and someone says, I'll give you £1 million, can I have 20% share of the company? There is no share of the company. So you can't get certain types of investment. If you are a company limited by guarantee, some people may not recognise you as a social enterprise. If you're a KIC, you're more signposted as a social enterprise, but you have weird powers to do. If you're a registered charity, they may say you can sell secondhand socks, but you can't sell DVDs. Co-ops, the issue with co-ops is often about the members, if they're unhappy, can vote you off as a director. Limited liabilities are a bit weird. I don't know many people have gone that way. It's a bit of a specialist niche. But what someone should do is listen to what you want to do, why you want to do it, and then say to you, for each of these, there's some pros and cons, and you will have real problems with these ones, but these ones might work for you, if that makes sense. It's probably the single most important thing I'd learn about legal structures. You can make any of them work. Some of them, you will have to put an awful lot of time and effort into making it work. You know, it's like saying you can get from here to Liverpool. You can get from here to Liverpool in a car, in a plane, by train, by skateboard, or you could walk. They all have pros and cons. But anyone who says you're going from here to Liverpool, you have to fly. There is no alternative. It's just an idiot. So, but there are people out there. And in fact, the person I was telling you rang me and said, I want to be a KIC, described his business model. And I went, well, you could. But if you're going to fundraise, it's a lot easier with a registered charity number. And there are a lot of funds who won't give you money unless you have a registered charity number. You know, because it gives them protections. Everyone's got quiet and looking at me. I don't know if that's just because this is dull, or no one understands it, or they're now thinking.
For me, it's a good thing.
Or they're like, is this... Do heckle, I really don't mind. Say, can we meet a minute? Or,
I think I just need to, perhaps, I want to know more about each one individually, that's all, because at the moment I'm like, well, I would have no idea.
Okay, so we'll do a bit of this, we'll come back to this later. So describe to me how you want to operate. What do you want to do? What's the service that you want to do? Bless you.
We want to employ
yeah.
people with learning disabilities to
okay.
get contracts from companies to actually go in and train them.
Okay.
With regard to how to employ and train them.
Okay. Do you want those people with learning disabilities to be full members of the organisation, to have representation on the board, and do you want to be held democratically accountable to those people with learning disabilities? And I'm not saying you should or shouldn't, you don't. Okay. Now, if you did, what I might say is, and there's a strand of these called social firms, which are a type of social enterprise, where one of their reasons for being is that they employ people with problems. I'm going to use the word problems, because it's a catch-all. Now, it could be people with learning disabilities. So there are people who say, we want our staff to have learning disabilities, we want the managers to, we want the directors to. Basically, we want to be held completely to account by people with learning disabilities. That kind of model lends itself quite well to a co-op, because in effect, all the members get together, they make collective decisions, they employ, you know, they approve the directors and so on. If that's not right for you, then that's probably not the right model. And probably not registered charity, because you'll struggle to trade. So you're probably looking at one of these. You could make these work, though. If you were stuck with this, you could make it work. But you're probably looking at this. The issues then might be, do you think you might need to raise startup money in the first 3 or 4 years? Might you need to get in, say, £500,000 or £1 million in the first 3 or 4 years?
Well, we definitely need some startup money. I wouldn't necessarily say it would be £500,000.
Okay.
But we need some startup money initially, yeah.
Okay. And that tends to be one of the discussions that changes that.
Right.
So if someone says to me they need to raise £500,000, that gives you more options to raise £500,000 than that does. But if you don't really need £500,000 in your first 4 years, and I say need, not want, actually that might work better for you. And this often looks more charitable. So some people, when they're looking at you, depending on who you're getting money from, they will react differently to each of these. So what I'm trying to tease out for you is what you should get is this dialogue, where I say, is this important to you? Is that important to you? Do you need this? Depending on your questions, the ratings of these will go up. And what you should hear from me is, well, here's the pros and cons of this, and here's why I think it might not work. Here's the pros and cons of this, why I think it might work. And then gradually what will start forming in your mind is, well, actually, there may be 2 or 3 different ways we could go with this. That's what a good lawyer discussion should sound like. If you come in and go, I want to be a social enterprise, and they go, you want to be that, then they've not listened to you, because each of you, your solutions could be different. And there's nothing wrong with that. I've run one of them, and I'm now one of them. And there's pros and cons to either of those. I've been on the board of one of them. I'm on the board of something that's about to go from one of them to one of them. And the rich discussions should be, okay, you know, why? Yeah.
Can you be one and have a relationship with another company or whatever that is the other? So, for example, could you be, let's say, a company limited by guarantee and be working with a limited liability partnership with someone else?
Yeah, you could. Now, again, it's more complicated. Where you tend to get that is where you've got existing structures in place.
Yeah.
So say you're a charity and you want to trade. Okay, if you're a charity, you can't convert a charity into any of those. There are sort of one-way routes. You can convert that into a charity, you convert that into a charity, you can't convert charity into that.
What would you have to do?
Basically, you definitely need advice. You write to Companies House. So I'm on the board of a social enterprise in Salford, and we're changing from a company limited by guarantee to a co-op, to Industrial Providence Society. And in fact, what's happened is we've spent 6 months with the board, with the members. We looked at what we wanted to do and said, why are we struggling with this model? Why might this be better for us? We've had legal advice. We've done the pros and cons of each one. As a board, we then come to a decision. And then we're now going through a six-month process. But it's something you have to take your time over and get it right. Because if you get it wrong, when I went to Equity and I said, and we said, we're a company limited by guarantee, and they said, oh, you need equity. So I'm like, equity? I'm on Google. What's equity? Oh, that's equity. Watch a couple of episodes of Dragon's Den. Right, I think, get the hang of this. Right, I want to change from that to that. Company's House went, no, you can't. That's illegal. You cannot do it. Oh, okay. bun. And they said, well, you could create one of them and have that as a subsidiary. So you could create two companies. And I was like, oh, right. And in fact, that's what we were going to do when our investor said, why? And we explained to him, and he said, well, actually, I'm going to end up paying for the legal costs of that. So do you know what? Don't bother, guys. Stay as you are, and we'll just restructure the deal. So you can have, for instance, you could have a charity. Let's say you're Oxfam, and you want to sell Oxfam DVDs, and the Charity Commission says you can't. Oxfam could create one of these that has a relationship with Oxfam that pays Oxfam money. So I was, for instance, I was on the board of the Royal College of Nursing. The Royal College of Nursing is a registered charity. It also has a company limited by guarantee. It also has a relationship, I think, with a limited liability partnership. And because it created Nursing Standard, which was a magazine which it was selling, and under charity law it couldn't do it, so it had to create an entity to sell the magazine. But then what happened is the charity, I think actually it might be company limited by shares, so the charity owns 51% of the shares, so it's what they call a wholly owned subsidiary. But you can get, it can get really technical, and it can get really, if like me you were new to the world of business, it can all get a bit whoosh. So the issue keeps going back to what do you want to do, what's important to you, and we'll ask you a few key questions. Depending on those responses, there are different solutions.
Going back to the Oxfam example. Would Companies House or would somebody stop this idea of having a profit-making arm that pays to Oxfam? Because Oxfam is synonymous with being a charity.
No, because the beauty is, if you're a private company and you want to give money to Oxfam, that's legal. So in a sense, they'd say, yeah, you can be profit-making. Oxfam can get money off whoever. Colombian drug dealers can get money to Oxfam.
Would they allow to use the same brand?
That's where it might get interesting. And that's where it depends on... It depends. And this is where it goes to the power of the regulator. One of the issues of being a registered charity or a KIC is you have much tougher regulation. So these guys can stop you doing things. A KIC can stop you... You could say, I'm going to set up Oxfam DVD. The charity could actually stop you. Companies House couldn't stop you, but what the Charity Commission may say is, you can't use the word Oxfam because we think that's misleading. So the KIC can stop you. The KIC actually has more powers than the Charity Commission. The KIC can remove you as a director. The KIC can stop you trading. The KIC can decide to sue someone on your behalf.
But you get round it by saying, actually, we're Play.com ploughing 95% of all profits into Oxfam or something, don't you?
You could do that, yeah. Yes, anyone can give, any of these can give money to any of the others. The issue is whether or not, is whether the regulator will let, and basically these are very lightly regulated. Anyone can do one of these, you know. These are more tightly regulated, and that might be one of the questions to ask, is let's look at the regulation framework. Is that going to be too restricting for you to do what you want to do? So, sorry.
I just wanted to ask, I've been told with regard to the companies, that's why I asked the question earlier about whether there has to be a board. I was originally told it had to be a minimum of three on board, and I noticed you mentioned earlier
it's two.
But those people on board can't actually get paid by the company. And of course, we want to set it up as a business.
Yeah.
We're not going to be spending hours working and having to work to earn a living as well. So one of my concerns was that we would have to either take on board other directors that weren't part of the business, being employed, paid a salary, you know, just perhaps people we knew and that could potentially sack us at some point, purely so that we could actually work within the company and receive a salary without having extravagant bonuses.
Yeah.
And that's the part that I want to understand.
Complete tosh. It falls into a category that I call... sex tips from virgins. You get an awful lot of people who tell you how to run a business that know sod all about it, have never done it in their life, that give you the biggest load of horse, and because you don't know any better, I don't mean it in a funny way, because we had the same. We had people saying this stuff, and then people, oh, load of tosh, who told you that? And what you find is the first question I ask, and in fact, you know, I say to people, what gives me the right to stand up here talking to you? Arguably nothing, apart from the fact I've done a bit of it, and I'll tell you about my experience. What I say may or may not be right, check it up, we'll give you sources, but what you will get is you will get people say, I am an authoritative business advisor. First question I ask any business advisor, tell me about the companies you've set up. and run. Not just been on the board of, set up and run. And when they go, whack, and most of them used to be in the bank. And when they say, I haven't done it, you go, that's very interesting. So now you're a virgin. Virgins have opinions on how sex should be performed, but I'd be very careful what advice I took from them. And I would check it out with someone that's maybe had a shag. So that's kind of my view on this stuff. I would test it out with someone who's run a business. And in fact, there's the published literature on running a business, which you can find and is out there, and you get some real myths. When we started out in our first year, which is probably my passion on why I do this stuff and why I do it for free, is we went to business advisors, we got books on how to run businesses, we tried all this stuff, we found a lot of it didn't work, some of it was disastrous decisions. We learnt the hard way, and we then found other people learnt the hard way. So one of my missions in life is people, if I can help people avoid some of the rubbish, you're going to make some mistakes, but if I can help you avoid some of the big mistakes we made, then that's great. But there's an industry out there that tells people how to run businesses who, you know, don't know what they're talking about. And I've heard stuff like that. Oh, you're on the board of directors. If you're on the board of directors, you can't be paid. Oh, so how does Richard Branson earn his yacht then? Because he's on the board of every single one of those. And Bill Gates appears to be the world's richest man. Is he maybe the secretary of the people that run Microsoft? And then they go, you know. Now, if you're on a board of a registered charity, it's a bit different. But even then, I mean, non-execs of public sector bodies get paid. They get paid a lump of money. So, yeah.
Do it as expenses, volunteering expenses.
Or a retainer.
Well, there's expenses. They get paid five grand a year for 2 days' work, most of it. If you're the non-exec of a foundation trust, you get paid 10 grand for 24 days' work. Not bad. You know? There are a lot of misconceptions, and if you hear it from other people, I'd test it out, try it on various things and just say I've heard this, but there's a lot of people who say a lot of rubbish, and it can end up putting people down the wrong direction. So yeah, if you're the director, you can get paid anything you want. Yeah, you can make £10 million, pay yourself £5 million a year as director. That's kind of what the private sector do. The interesting thing is social, and there are some quite well paid social enterprise directors. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. It's kind of what you're doing with your profit, you know, and do you need to recruit people and the rest of it? So, sorry, Joe, were you trying to...
Well, I forgot what it was.
That's what happens when I rabbit.
Yeah.
Get me to...
So how does the regulator then, if you're a community interest company, decide what's a reasonable...
He doesn't. Really. I'm not aware of him ever jumping down anyone's throat. And in fact, I think the director of Oxfam's on... $250,000, I think. But you could argue the TOS, where you look at the turnover and the number of staff, and it's a multinational company. I mean, funny enough, I'm on the board of a couple of social enterprises, as well as the ones I've set up. And one of the things I've done is you look at the NCVO, the National Council of Voluntary Organisations, do like salary band charts. So if you're setting one up and you have issues like, well, what do we pay the chief exec and what do we pay the... You know, if you're going to be the chief exec, fair enough, pay whatever you want to pay. But you might think, well, if I'm going to hire a director of finance, what do I need to pay? They'll give you bandings. And they'll say stuff like, well, depending on your turnover, here's the kind of average. And depending on where you are in the world, here's the sort of average. So if you're trying to recruit someone, here's the kind of market rate you're probably going to need to advertise at. But I'm not aware of anyone. And I'm not even aware of the Charities Commission jumping in. But having said that, you have got a board and you've got mechanisms. So, for instance, the chief exec's pay on the one of the boards I'm on is decided by a number of us, and the chief exec isn't in the room. So we get together and we look at the company, what we can afford, what the going rate is, what else we're doing with the money, and then we make those decisions. So, yeah.
I remember the question. Is it, kind of going back to that sort of made-up example about Oxfam having a trading arm, the fact that it's regulated. Are the regulators kind of fairly, I suppose, fair or whatever, in respect that, let's say, let's say Oxfam's trading arm, I would assume, puts all the profits from the DVDs or games or whatever it is into, well, like a social enterprise, doing what they do. Are the regulators fairly kind of sensible, I suppose, about saying, oh, well, we'll let you do that because you're clearly, that's what you're doing with the...
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think the KIC regulators and the Charity Commission, because the Charity Commission regulates charities, you know, by and large, they seem okay. I can't think of any... I certainly can't think of an example where there's been a massive outcry on a decision they've made, but they've got certain powers and you may just need to think about it. And if... well, for instance, the KICs only ever turned down one application to be a KIC. And it was very high profile, and it was a sadomasochism community that wanted to set up a profit-making enterprise to support sadomasochism clubs. And they went, no. And in fact, a lot of people went, well, why is that different to a food cooperative, which is selling something different? And they went, well, we're just not, you know.
Okay.
But interestingly, there are some brothel cooperatives. There's certainly in India and Amsterdam. That at some point they may emerge. There may be some cases that push it a bit. People go, what is it you're doing? If someone said, here's fair trade heroin, we're going to give a better deal to heroin farmers. Could be interesting. But so far, they haven't really jumped down anyone's throat. But you need to... They tend to get worse where it's things like fraud. So a director's pocketing money inappropriately... or if the members and the board fall out and elections are. It's more processy type stuff. Mm. I mean, most directors get struck off for not sending in their annual return to Companies House. In a sense, they don't mind what you do, you know. You can sniff cocaine from lap dancers all day long, but if you don't send the right form into Companies House, they'll strike you off as a director. So there's some really weird stuff about, you know, there are legal responsibilities to director, but by and large, you basically have to go to prison for fraud or... You know, or if you go bankrupt and they decide you ran it fraudulently or not on behalf of the shareholders, then they can remove you. But, you know, if you're interested, what I'd probably do is, it's particularly if you're looking at those two, is I might just go on the website and say, well, okay, what's the regulator been doing for the last 2 years? Let's look at some of the test cases. It's kind of like nursing and doctors. You look at the NMC and the GM, see what they strike people off for, and it gives you then a sense of what they're like as a regulator. So, okay. Is it worth a quick 5 minute breather? Just get up, stretch our legs around, get some tea and coffee. Because it's like, because I'm conscious at the moment this is like sucking all this information. But the thing is, if you vaguely know your way around it, there are sources of material I can point you to. And the most important thing is, you should be hearing this kind of stuff from the people you're talking to. If you're not hearing this kind of stuff, you need to get someone else. You know, if people say the answer is X, I'd worry. You know, so. Okay.
That was the end of part two of the workshop. My name's been Dave Dawes. This has been brought to you by entrepreneurs.net. The music's Fire Dance by DJ Booley under a Creative Commons license. And part three will be next week.